It's Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Nick Austin, filling in for Stephen Henderson, and so glad to be with you today. If you haven't been keeping up with the news around Israel or don't have any connection to the country, you'd be forgiven for missing a lot of internal disruption that's happening over there. Israel has seen about 11 weeks of mass protests that have flooded into the streets. And more recently, those protests only picked up steam. On March 12th alone, about 500,000 Israelis engaged in street protests. That's all because the right-wing government of Israel, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, threatened to impose significant political controls on its judicial branch. Netanyahu did that because he was indicted on corruption charges and feared that he would be thrown in prison. The country is so close to authoritarianism that even former center-right Prime Minister Ehud Olmert went so far as to declare that, quote, the government of Israel is the enemy of the state of Israel and that people need to be protesting it. As of yesterday, Netanyahu announced that he would delay judicial changes, probably to tame the protesters. But this still leaves us with a lot of questions, like why is Israel closer to losing its democracy in the first place? Is the trend in Israel indicative of rising democracy backsliding going on in places like Brazil, India, and right here in America? And how should Americans be reacting to the protests and undemocratic practices going on in Israel? To discuss all of this, we have two guests with us. Dalia Shinlin is a fellow at the Century Foundation, and she is also a columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Dalia, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Ishan Tharoor, who is a foreign affairs columnist at the Washington Post. Ishan, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Great to be back with you.
Thank you. Dalia, I'm going to start with you because are you in Israel right now? I mean, what are things like at the ground? Let us know how you're doing.
Thank you for asking. I am in Tel Aviv right now. Yesterday, I went to some demonstrations in the morning in Tel Aviv at various traffic junctions around the city, and then I went to Jerusalem, which was an adventure in itself because just getting to the train station in Tel Aviv meant crossing huge protests on the street. Streets were closed down, as they had been since the previous night. The trains were full to the point where people could not get on the trains to go to Jerusalem with protesters. Once we got to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, the entire area of the city was completely flooded with protesters. The numbers are enormous. I mean, we're talking, I don't know if we have final numbers, but 200,000 people roughly. And that was all day until those protesters against the government's plans to constrain the independence of the judiciary, those protesters went home and were replaced by pro-government protesters in the evening who also flooded the area. Back in Tel Aviv, the anti-government protesters or the anti-judicial reform protesters were still there in Tel Aviv. And there is that's all in addition to the fact that much of the country was simply on strike because the major labor union joined the calls for them to call a general strike. So major swaths of the economy were on strike, on hold. And there was a general sense that normality was suspended while everybody was waiting for the government to decide whether to continue with these reforms or delay them. And of course, the government did eventually decide to postpone the legislation that will essentially constrain, or some people think, end judicial independence. But the legislation is only on hold. So today, there is something like a tense pause while everybody tries to figure out, you know, their new position going forward, both the government and the opposition and the protesters, who are not exactly political. These are people from all walks of life and society, and of course the political opposition. So everybody's kind of revising their positions, thinking about what will happen next with this very sensitive legislation.
I want to break down in terms of this sensitive legislation exactly what the impact of it would be, especially for us here, as we've had our own concerns about potentially illiberalism, as I might say, backsliding of our democracy, losing our ability to have our democracy. You look at Israel, it is a place with a democratically elected government. It also has an independent judiciary like we have here also. And so whereas we have concerns here in America, perhaps we can look to what's happening in Israel right now as maybe a little bit of insight into how things can go. So let's kind of break down what exactly they're planning to do with the judiciary and why it's such a big deal in Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first point to keep in mind is that in Israel's political system, we are, first of all, missing a formal constitution, which both means we which means that on the one hand, we have no clear formulation of the balance of powers within government. These have all been defined by piecemeal laws over the years. So there's a lot of ambiguity about the nature of governance and the relationship between the different branches of government. But the main thing is that we also have no clear checks and balances on the executive power or clear separation between our legislature and executive other than one thing. Structurally, the main constraint on those two branches of government has been the independent judiciary. So we don't have something like a federal system. We don't have this written constitution. We don't have a president who has a veto. We have a parliamentary system, and the executive is made up of a majority of parliamentarians. So the executive basically has control over the legislature with that majority, and there's nothing really to restrain its power at the institutional and structural level. There are some de facto constraints, primarily that we have about a gazillion parties here who are always competing, and they're fractious, and governments generally don't have a majority based on one party. They always have to go into coalitions, so they have some natural constraints, but not structural or legal or institutional, except for the independent judiciary. And the government's plans essentially said, we don't want these minimal constraints that we have, a judiciary, and specifically the Supreme Court, that has over the years been able to push back against executive action that is overreach as far as the court is concerned. And since the 1990s, the court has also exercised judicial review of legislation. When they deem that legislation by the Knesset violates the human rights that have been stipulated in Israeli law, so the Israeli parliament passed laws defining certain human rights in the early 1990s, and since then, the court has said if the parliament tries to make a law that violates the rights that our parliament has committed to, we will rule that it's unconstitutional, even in the absence of a formal written constitution. The government is now saying we don't want any of those constraints. And as a result, they have developed a series of themes that the court is undermining the true voice of the people, that the court is intervening into the powers of the other branches of governance. And what they want to do is the kinds of legislation that they have been proposing and advancing would allow an automatic majority for members of the governing coalition, that is the executive branch, to choose the justices, destroying the delicate balance that we have now between political figures, justices, and professionals from the Israeli bar. And that would essentially mean complete political control over judicial appointment. And what they really want more than anything else is to be able to override any Supreme Court ruling against legislation that is deemed unconstitutional with a bare majority of parliamentarians, so that essentially parliament could make a law that violates human rights, and if the Supreme Court overrules it, the Knesset says, we don't care. We're overruling the Supreme Court anyway. Those are just two examples, but this is a whole series of laws that are essentially designed to give the executive and the legislature total control over the judiciary. I think that's how the protesters certainly see it.
Yeah, and I want to bring in Ishan Tharoor right now, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Ishan, I want to bring you in because I know you've been looking at this a lot as well. And we mentioned how there's so much going on in terms of the reaction there, the protests. Obviously, this has had a significant impact on the people there. I'm thinking in terms of historical context, have we seen a lot of this? What are you seeing from the reaction? What does it tell you about how people are feeling about these proposed changes in legislation?
Well, you know, what is obviously quite striking is the depth of polarization that we're seeing, you know, unfurl on the streets of Israel's cities, the extent to which there is a kind of brewing culture war in a country that is quite small in many ways. But I do think, you know, to pick up on Dalia's terrific explanation of the underlying themes and factors driving all this, you have these two really contrasting narratives. On one hand, among the protesters and those rallying against these judicial overhaul bills, you have this view that Israel is drifting in a certain way down the path of other illiberal democracies like Poland or Hungary. That's not in Europe and to a certain extent There are other demagogic illiberal leaders that you can point at who are have set certain precedents for Netanyahu. And then on the other hand, on the right, you have this narrative that the judiciary, the Supreme Court, is this bastion of a kind of secular left elite that needs to be taken down. And that is a narrative that is very familiar to anybody who's sitting in this country, in the United States, when you think about the grievance politics that's been mobilized by segments of the Republican Party caucus. And so I think those themes and those passions are very familiar in any context, especially in democracies around the world that are gripped by illiberal nationalist politics.
Yeah, and when we're talking about illiberalism in these democracies, again, that backsliding, that idea that you would have elected majority that gets in power, but then starts consolidating more and more power at the top, potentially taking it from the people to institute policies that folks might not like. I know that's a concern that we've had here in America. You mentioned it there a little bit, Ishan. Is there anything that we should be watching out for here in the U.S. and any information that we can pick up on it? What are you most interested in, and how does that connect with any analogies that we might have to the U.S. or other Western democracies?
You know, I'm not super focused on what precedents or templates the experience of Israel sets the United States. I think there are a lot of unique circumstances that shape the Israeli situation. Not least, you know, I think when we talk about Israeli democracy, there is a huge asterisk there, because Israel is also a place where there are millions of Palestinians who live under de facto military control with none of the democratic rights of their Israeli neighbors, and live in conditions that a number of prominent human rights organizations have deemed amounted apartheid. Yeah. So I don't want to overstate what Israel could reveal to the United States, but what is absolutely important is the American role in all this. You know, the United States and Israel have a profoundly deep relationship on so many fronts. There's American financiers and right-wing organizations based in the United States that have driven some of the legislation that's you know, dividing Israeli politics right now. And at the same time, you have a growing debate here in Washington and in some parts of the United States over, you know, the nature of America's ironclad support for Israel, particularly this government, which is the most right-wing government in Israeli history, which is populated by some incredibly extremist figures in Netanyahu's cabinet. And there are some voices that really want the Biden administration to be much tougher than it is right now.
Yeah. And we want to bring back Dalia into the conversation, because as Ishan mentioned there, of course, there's this other group of people who are under military control, as you just mentioned there. And I'm wondering, with this destabilization that could be happening, does that pose any potential for actually an increase in the voices of folks who were not getting heard as much when it related to what was happening in Parliament? Dalia, I want to ask you that question, because is there an opportunity now for the voices of folks who have been more oppressed to finally get a little bit more of a voice and say in government in Israel?
Well, that's a complicated question, but of course, I thank you, Sean, very much for raising the issue, because it is, you know, part of any basic understanding of Israel that there have been very deep flaws to the point of missing legs of democracy in Israel, certainly because of the occupation, because Israel is controlling about 5 million Palestinians who do not have citizenship, and that does relate to your question, because they don't have any voice right. in Israeli representative right. bodies. They're not represented at all as citizens, because they're not citizens. But even before the occupation, we have to remember that Israel also was governing part of its own citizens, its Arab or Palestinian citizens of Israel. For the first nearly 20 years of the statehood, were also governed under a military regime. In other words, Israel has accustomed itself to a kind of democracy that includes very undemocratic practice. And from Israelis' perspective, that's okay, that's democracy. So even though I think most people would find that kind of practice certainly irreconcilable with a democracy, these are part of the historic flaws. Are those people, specifically Palestinians under occupation, going to have more of a voice? No, but there is a very interesting debate going on among the protesters, because many protesters make the connection that I just made following on Ishan's point, which is that you can't really talk about fulfilling democratic promise or even democratic values unless Israel divests itself of this practice of holding population under a military government and martial law, and precluding, preventing them from having self-determination for so many decades. But the vast majority of the protesters, I would say, don't want to bring that issue in. They have successfully compartmentalized it and left it out of the conversation about democracy altogether. And this is a debate, at least the fact that there is a debate about it, is in some ways an opportunity. Because for a long time, again, Israelis were able to compartmentalize and for legitimate reasons say, well, we can't reach a peace agreement with the Palestinians now. They're very complicated factors. We don't trust them. They don't trust us. There's violence. And just push to the side. But I think the question about having being forced to approach the questions of democracy at this point because of the sense of threat, Jewish Israelis in general, and, of course, Palestinian citizens, Arab citizens of Israel, who've always been much more aware of these things, are confronting what democracy truly means. It's an extraordinary moment. We're seeing public free lectures about democracy by constitutional law experts all over the place and debates that haven't been had. And I think that in that context, the question of how we reconcile the fact that these are basically irreconcilable practices, occupation and democracy, are being raised. And there is, I think, a growing sense of urgency among those who have been protesting against occupation policies for many years, that this is an opportunity to bring the contradiction to the general public. But it's very early to tell whether that will actually have a widespread change, certainly given that the leadership continues to be extremely right-wing and doesn't want anything to do with that conversation. And we have to remember that that is the leadership that won elections.
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated situation, and I really can't say that there's going to be some sort of democratic representation for Palestinians over the people who control them, which is the Israeli state, through the army anytime soon. But at least the direction may open up that conversation.
All right. We're talking with Dalia Shinlin, who's in Israel right now, a columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, as well as Ishan Tharoor, a foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. We want to speak with you as well. 313-577-1019. Again, 313-577-1019. Give us a call. Share your thoughts. What do you make of the protests in Israel and democratic backsliding that we are seeing in places worldwide? We'll bring you into the conversation. We'll continue on Detroit Today in just a moment. It's Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Nick Austin, filling in for Stephen Henderson, having a conversation about Israel's democracy and the protests that are happening over there, joined by two great guests, Ishan Tharoor of The Washington Post, as well as Dalia Shinlin, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation. We also want to hear from you as well. You can give us a call, 313-577-1019, to let you know what you make of the protests. What do you think of America's role in promoting democracy in places like Israel and elsewhere? Should we be doing it? Should we not? Are we doing it well? And Ishan, it is one question I want to have for you, because one of the reasons I recall when it was being sold that America would spend so much money in a place like Israel and was promoting democracy, one of the bastions of democracy that you could find in the Middle East. So that's why a lot of funding was going to the area. However, moves like what's happening right now with the more right-wing government, what Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to do in terms of judiciary, would show me that that's moving away from democracy. So does America play a role in this? How does that fit into our role of promoting democracy? And is there anything that we can do to help promote more democracy in a place like that, or should we even be doing it? Go ahead, Ishan.
Well, I mean, there's a long history. There's a long history of American rhetoric and idealism smashing against its more cynical realpolitik in the Middle East, and I don't think Israel is any exception to that. What's important is that this week Biden is hosting a summit for democracies in Washington and some other cities in the world as well. This is the signature kind of ideological plank of the Biden administration when they came to power. Part of restoring American leadership on the world stage after 4 years of disruptive Trumpism was that we would have this kind of overt return to principles and ideals of democracy that both anchor supposedly America's place in the world, as well as a more kind of expansive internationalist vision of what America should be when it comes to its own policies elsewhere and what America should pursue. And I think, you know, this is a pretty awkward timing right now, because we do believe that Netanyahu will be addressing the Summit for Democracy in a pre-recorded speech. There's been no indication so far from the Biden administration that they're going to can that speech. Also, you know, we've also learned that Netanyahu has received an invite to the White House. Now, whether this is a sign that the Biden administration wants to keep Netanyahu on side and believes that the best way of approaching the situation is by speaking to Netanyahu closely and directly, rather than alienating him publicly in some way, perhaps that's the approach that the White House is taking. But it doesn't really look that great when you've seen the weeks of really intense protests take place in Israel, when you've seen the rhetoric coming out from figures of Netanyahu's cabinet who deny the existence of Palestinians as a people and who call for de facto genocide in the occupied territories. It's very unclear to me to the extent to which the Biden administration is willing to exert any of its leverage over this Israeli government. And so I think that's a bit of a blemish when we talk about the Summit of Democracies. The Summit of Democracies as a concept in general is also particularly troubled, because other major democracies have raised their own red flags as well. You've seen in India, the world's biggest democracy, the de facto excommunication from political life of the main opposition leader, and the United States has been basically silent about the whole thing. So for that idealistic American project, it's about to crash against the rocks of, right, of, you know, difficult geopolitics, basically.
So then let's unpack that a little bit more, Dolly. I'll bring you back into the conversation. You know, we've used this term illiberalism a lot, the backsliding of a democratic government into more authoritarianism. If the goal was allegedly to promote liberalism, to promote democracy in the Middle East, if they're moving towards illiberalism elsewhere in other territories where we were promoting that, Dahlia, what might that mean for us in America? Why should Americans care about any backsliding that would happen in Israel in terms of their government and illiberalism?
Oh, I mean, it's a good question. I think this is exactly the dilemma that America has been in by, you know, conveying that it supports an idealism and democracy promotion around the world, while actually, you know, having largely an interest-based foreign policy over the years and, you know, including even under the Biden administration, as much as there has been rhetoric about bringing these ideals back, certainly we really haven't seen it in the case of Israel, where America has been very passive on it. I think one point that I would keep in mind is that authoritarian leaders or illiberal leaders, you know, they feed off each other. They learn from each other. They take tactics from one another. And when they feel they have lots of allies, or that they're part of a wave of, you know, growing kind of support for these authoritarian leaders who would roll back, you know, the hard-earned gains of democracy over all these years, I think that simply supports them in other places. And so, you know, it's no accident that among Netanyahu's foreign allies is a whole list of illiberal, nationalist, populist, xenophobic, and, you know, frankly, proto-authoritarian or outright authoritarian leaders. Whether it's, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Netanyahu has in the past boasted of his relationship with Vladimir Putin. He was close, obviously, a long-term friendship with Donald Trump, who, you know, I don't know if your listeners would agree with my categorization, but I don't think Donald Trump was a great supporter of democracy. And so I think that these leaders certainly support one another. That's, you know, these reflect where countries are likely to go when they feel they have support from other allies around the world. And I think that, you know, for historically, America has felt that Israel is an ally because of its shared values. And this facilitates strong political partnerships in the international sphere, in commerce and trade, you know, in the economic sphere, and also in terms of geopolitics. So when you have the basis for the value, the shared values kind of crumbling, the question is whether those alliances will serve you as well in foreign policy and, you know, in the geopolitical sphere as you need. I mean, there are a number of ways that I think that countries get along better when they have similar regimes, and particularly democratic regimes, and that's all without even raising the question of whether democracies are less likely to go to war, which they are, less likely to go to war with each other. Not that America and Israel have that problem, but you know, there is a sense that the more democracies in the world, the less they will at least go to war with each other. And so, you know, again, as Ishan pointed out, historically, and if you go back to the creation of the UN and American idealism, there was a sense that it is good for the world if there are more democracies in it. And I think that that's where America risks losing a sense of vision and leadership in its own foreign policy vision.
Yeah, you know, I those are all great points. And I think about, especially when we're talking about Palestinians who are in the area, which has been brought up, especially if there's more ability for an authoritarian government to inflict even more pain on a people already receiving so much pain, that would also cause a lot of concern for an America that expresses certain ideals of how people should be treated, of democracy, of allowing people to have a say. But I want to present that question also to you, Ishan, to give you an opportunity to respond. Why should Americans care about what's going on over in Israel?
Well, I mean, there's, you know, Americans don't have to care about anything.
Well, right.
To be completely honest.
Right.
But, and there is a wing of American politics now where there are many people making the case that the U.S. should be disentangled from crises elsewhere and should be less invested in making these crises either better or, in many cases, worse. But as Dalia said, our domestic politics bleeds over into these foreign policy conversations. Trump administration, President Trump, very much himself, was was the preeminent illiberal nationalist on the world stage for a number of years, and in many ways found a whole cohort of ideological bedfellows in Hungary in the shape of Netanyahu, and so to a certain extent when you are watching American politics, you do see it mirrored in various ways elsewhere and vice versa. What's fascinating, especially when you think about the American conversation about Israel and Palestine, or Israelis and Palestinians, is that polling does show certain interesting and potentially very important shifts. There is a recent one that came out just this past week that showed for probably the first time more Americans under the age of 30 are sympathetic to the Palestinians over the Israelis.
Mm.
Which is a pretty profound revelation. I think there's a reality, there's a recognition, perhaps more so among younger Americans, that the nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and yeah, perhaps not even conflict, but just the political dispensation that currently exists, is unfair, unequal, unjust, and needs to be changed. And also that our tax dollars are going to underwrite the security establishment in Israel in many ways, and why is that still the case?
Right.
And so there is a shifting shifting political winds. I wouldn't overstate those because there's still ironclad bipartisan support for Israel in many ways. But times may be changing.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you, Ishan Tharoor of the Washington Post and Dalia Shinlin of the Century Foundation for joining us on Detroit Today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's 101.9 WDET, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. Tune in tomorrow when we discuss a new Atlantic podcast about what Martin Luther King's assassination and the subsequent uprisings meant for America in the 60s and what it means for us today.